and welcome to another edition of Sunday Review, featuring the best stories from the Spring 2011 SUNY Oneonta Audio Documentary Production Class. I'm your host and instructor of the course, Kayana Torosyan.
I still talk to you in my sleep. I don't say much because the hurt runs too deep.
Today's program begins with a trip to the farmland. Who would think that a South American mini camel would find its second home in the pastures of upstate New York? Anthony Sylvester reports.
The world of livestock ownership can take many different routes, but one less traveled yet gaining in popularity is that of llama and alpaca ownership. These South American animals, which have only came up to the United States in the past 30 years, are now becoming a growing industry for products that can be made from their fiber, equivalent to what you would consider wool on a sheep, as well as them being great pets to own. Sue Kasten, the owner of Patchwork Meadow Alpacas in Canajoharie, New York, explains what can be done with alpaca fiber, which is probably some of the softest material out there.
Their fiber is shorn once a year, and it's used either for roving for spinners. We get it made into yarn for, you know, to be knit or crocheted into hats and or sent to a textile industry. It can be made into fabric. Alpacas first came to the United States in the 1980s. They've been in South America for thousands of years. They've been domesticated for over 2,000 years. It really is an international industry. There are many alpacas in Canada and in Australia, and as I say, South America, and they're branching out into Europe as well. And we're, as I say, a relatively young industry here, but we're really branching out on the fiber aspect.
The difference between the two animals lies within their size and fiber. Both are in the same family as the camel. The alpaca, however, is smaller and was domesticated for its rich fiber. The llama, while also possessing valuable fiber, is bred mainly as a pack animal. One very unique use of the llama is to guard animals that might not be able to defend themselves. In this situation, a llama is placed with a flock of sheep or goats and eventually considers them part of its family. Tabitha Habold is the owner of the Long Island Livestock Company in Yaphank, New York, and has used guard llamas in the past.
A really good guard llama, if they feel like their family of sheep and or goats are being threatened, they're going to put themselves in between that predator and the flock of sheep or goats, and they will act to protect them, whether it be stomping with their front feet, perhaps spitting, certainly chasing after the predator, and a really good guard will do what they need to do, hopefully, to protect both themselves and their family of sheep and goats.
An aspect of the industry that has grown are llama and alpaca shows. These shows, which happen all across the country, have brought llama and alpaca owners and breeders together to see who has raised and trained the best animal.
While there are shows in different areas of the country, there's always new shows coming out. We do have a national group, the Alpaca Owners and Breeders Association, so we stick with AOBA-certified shows, which means that the alpacas have to fall into categories. We have to follow certain rules in showing them. And there are farms with several hundred alpacas and up, and then there are farms that have 10 or 12 alpacas all competing. There are halter shows that are based on showing the alpaca and how they walk, their movement, as I say, their conformation, their body style, and also their fiber.
One event, the Virginia Classic in Charleston, Virginia, is a llama and alpaca show specifically designed with the owners in mind. Show superintendent and founder of the now 17-year-old show, Paige McGrath, explains.
The inspiration for the show, which was originally held in the fall, was to have a llama show and alpaca show available to exhibitors that isn't in the middle of the summer associated with a county or state fair, because at that time those were your only options and you were traveling in the heat. And I wanted to create a show that was designed for the exhibitor and not necessarily for the public, although the public is welcome and certainly it's catered towards that. But it was really to have a show or an event where the exhibitors were the focus and they were happy and they're getting all the bells and whistles. You know, the premiums are important, pretty awards, anything that would make the show more pleasant.
At the Virginia Classic, I ran into Kelly Ralph, owner of the Lazy Llama Ranch in Long Island, who talked about the different kinds of performance competitions that llamas are put through.
Think of a dog show. People are very familiar with dog shows. They watch the dogs go around the ring, jump through hoops, things like that. Llamas, it's very similar. They do have a halter class where they're looking at conformation, they're looking at fiber, they're looking at how they walk. And then they have what they call performance classes. They have public relations, obstacle, and pack. Llamas are pack animals, so that's one of the reasons they have a pack class. But at that point, they go through maybe through a little weave. They go over bridges. They do teeter-totters.
One element of the shows has always been the youth division. Children as young as 5 and as old as 18 come to the shows and compete against others in their age group. These events can be just as competitive as the adult ones. Tabitha Habolt also has her own show team, training children on llama showmanship and animal husbandry.
We developed the Long Island Livestock Company Youth Show Team. And so kids come to the farm on a weekly basis to get involved in what we call llama lessons. And it's the same principle of hands-on learning, learning about the animal, how to care for the animal, learning what we call theory, that might be about anatomy, about herd health management, and then of course learning how to show them in showmanship and in performance, and then hopefully if they like, then they can take what they've learned and they can take it to an actual show or an actual competition to be able to match up their skills with other kids that are learning and doing the same thing.
Judges for the shows are certified by any of 3 different sanctioning organizations that deal with llamas, alpacas, or both. Judge Hank Kaufman says what makes him keep coming back to the shows. A positive sentiment shared by many.
My favorite classes to judge are halter classes. I love to judge halter classes. But the favorite thing about shows is I have in the last 20-some years met so many friends and made so many friends, and I see them at the show, and that's my favorite.
We enjoy just sharing our lives with them because they are gentle. They are very unique.
Animals to care for. They're quiet, they're peaceful, they're beautiful, they're regal, but they're very intelligent, so they're easy to work.
For Public Radio, I'm Anthony Sylvester.
But I'm still looking for a promise, even I can.
Now let's move back to a more urban landscape and rediscover hockey. Jeremy Horowitz loves the game so much that he talks about it in his final project, although the pastime has already cost him a broken leg and who knows how many other injuries and bruises. But here he is, enthusiastic about hockey, Suco's own Jeremy Horowitz.
Time to start all over, make a new beginning.
One would think ice was required in order to play hockey. That's not the case for a group of Oneonta students. They frequently play roller hockey in the parking lot. Who needs all that bulky equipment and high-end sticks? This is the most unrefined, original form of the game. Just skates, pavement, and a ball. This is where true talent takes place, on the asphalt. I caught up with some of the roller hockey players to find out more.
I'm here with Matt, roller hockey player. Now Matt, I see you guys playing roller hockey every day. How do you establish a group of guys to play?
One day to start with one kid out of the parking lot, stick handling, shooting on net, and then another person saw him, and then from there, it just kind of grew. People just, random strangers had never met each other before, but just saw, in the rollerman zone. If you see people playing roller, you want to play, you just grab your stick, grab your blades, get out there and play.
Are you guys an official school-sponsored club, or you just play leisurely? How does that work?
Well, right now, we just play at our own leisure, but we're trying to become recognized clubs, give us a little more leeway in situations, maybe we could get a few dollars for, some extra balls and pucks and some tape. Basic equipment wouldn't be much, but we're actually trying to go club, and then the vision from there is to go from club to hopefully NCAA by 2014 when they turn on Fitzall Hall to build a roller rink there.
You know, I just love to come out here with the guys and just, you know, shoot the puck around, play a little bit. It's just a great way to stay in shape, you know.
How's it transitioned for your on-ice training?
Well, you know, the handling's a little different and the skate's a little different, but most of all, it's just like a good way to keep in shape.
Listen to the sound of a roller hockey game. You're about to hear everything the game has to offer. Skates gliding, sticks clattering against the pavement, pucks hitting the back of the net, and players chattering. Everything combined makes for a truly special sound, and by listening to it, it's like you almost have skates on your feet and are dangling around the competition.
You know that time was going to get wrecked, right?
No, we're a bunch of ample rolling players.
You're going to take my surgical hand.
That time was going to get
destroyed.
What if you had to choose, ice or roller?
Is that even a serious question? It's gotta be roller. Roller, you can just, you know, any time of day, just strap on your blades and play roller. You can play 1v0 roller, 1v1 roller, there's all types of roller. You can always work on your surgical hands, small space games. So just, roller's way more versatile, where ice is just kind of, you know, ice. But roller, there's hundreds and hundreds of types of roller, so definitely roller.
What is your roller specialty? If you had to choose one, what are you best at?
My specialty, or what I'm known for throughout the SUNY Oneonta roller community, is probably for a rocket hard shot. It's actually been clocked at 102.3 miles an hour, which would put it in the top 1 percentile in the NHL. The only problem, though, with this hard shot is it's very, very inaccurate. I can't hit the side of a building if I tried. I mean, I can rip it through the net if I hit the net, but I just can't hit the net. Something I gotta work on. So I'd say my specialty is a rocket hard shot with zero accuracy.
I've also heard rumors about your hands. They're said to be magical.
No, you heard wrong. My hands are actually surgical. I've actually had a doctor observe my hands, and he said he did his residency, he went to medical school, and he's never seen surgical hands quite like mine.
Being a hockey player is more than just playing a sport. You're entering a world where you will meet your best friends for life and laugh harder than you ever will when you're older. Hockey is the only sport where you can meet a fellow hockey player, and within an hour, you're throwing beers back and forth like the best of friends. This is because we all have a common bond, a bond unlike any other sport in the world. When you pick up that stick, you're not only picking up a small piece of history, you're joining the biggest underground fraternity in the world. Welcome to Team Hockey.
That was SUCO's own Jeremy Horowitz. Welcome back to Sunday Review's Student Edition. I'm Guyana Torosyan, bringing you the best audio documentary projects from my spring 2011 class.
Sweet and high at the break of dawn, a simple tune that you can hum along to. I remember there was a time when I used to sing for you.
Our next story is from the only female student in that 17-strong group. Jessica Mosier talks about the place where she practices her favorite sport, trap shooting.
I
Wingmasters is a charming place nestled in the hills of Lapeer, New York. The scenic views and country air give you a sense of peace. But you won't get any peace and quiet because Wingmasters is a sportsman's club. And what is the sport of choice? Trap shooting.
Trap shooting is a shooting sport, one of the three major shooting sports that involve shooting flying clay pigeons with shotguns. Clay pigeons are basically clay discs that are usually orange colored. And the reason that they are called clay pigeons is because when the game first started, they actually shot at live pigeons.
Jefferson Adams of Marathon, New York, discovered trap shooting over 10 years ago when he was 13 years old. And Adams has been an avid trap shooter ever since.
I found out about Wingmasters in this classic clay target program when I was in seventh grade. We had a program that was for new shooters, and I thought it would be interesting to try it. And from that, I met Mr. Janky, and I guess you'd say the rest is history.
Lester Janky is a longtime resident of Lapeer, New York. Janky is the owner and founder of Wingmaster Sportsman's Club.
Wingmaster Sportsman's Club was developed as a venue for young people to come and learn the sport of trap shooting, and to do it in an atmosphere that is family-oriented, safe, and just to teach them the basics so that maybe later on in life they can pick this up and enjoy the sport. It came about because I wasn't very happy seeing that kids today really didn't have a place to go where the sport could be fostered and where people such as myself could teach them how to safely handle firearms.
A national organization that also believes in teaching young adults firearm safety is the Scholastic Shooting Sports Foundation, which founded the Scholastic Clay Target Program. SCTP is an educational athletic organization that exists to introduce young adults to the clay target sport. SCTP also facilitates continued involvement by providing, promoting, and perpetrating opportunities to safely and enjoyably participate and compete in a high-quality team-based sport. The development of the Scholastic Clay Target Program inspired Janky to become an SCTP certified coach.
The Scholastic Clay Target Program, it's a national program, and it was started by Bill Christie back in the late 90s. And again, it was a program that was brought about to teach primarily the safety aspects of firearms handling, utilizing volunteers throughout the country. I found out about it actually through our ATA publication, Trap and Field. Bill had some blurbs in there in different columns looking for volunteers, and I volunteered for New York State. And one thing led to another, and it just took off in New York.
Trap shooting is not just fun and games. In order to even handle a firearm, you have to pass Janky's test, which involves showing him that you can be trusted.
Responsibility is the main thing. There is no sport that has more responsibility involved with it than the sport of trap shooting. And we don't let young people here handle firearms until we feel they're ready. Sometimes they feel they're ready, but we don't feel they're ready, so they don't handle firearms until they've passed our series of requirements. And we make them understand that there's no second chances with firearms. You have to obey the rules or, somebody's life could be changed forever.
Even though trap shooting may not sound like your cup of tea, a lot of people find it challenging and exciting. You have to be headstrong and have a competitive nature in order to shoot with the big shots. But there is a softer side. It brings people together, people who share the same ambitions, and it can really leave a big influence on your life. It has done just that for Adams.
I would say that trap shooting did have a big impact on my life. When I was in high school, trap shooting was really my sport. I met a lot of good people, a lot of people that I'm friends with still today, and lots of people that were good examples for me to look up to.
Janky agrees with Adams and feels that Wingmasters and trap shooting has changed his life forever.
Oh, it's absolutely left an impact. I've met young people that have just actually inspired me to continue doing what we do here. And I hope to do it as long as I possibly can. But no, the interaction with the other coaches made some of the best friends I've ever had with fellow coaches. And it's just been inspiring to see what the young people today are capable of.
Do you think you are ready to make your mark and shoot for more? Step up to the line and give it a shot. I dare you. This is Jessica Mosier. Keep on shooting. I'm a girl.
Jessica Mosier is currently an intern at News Channel 34 in Binghamton, and you better remember that voice. She may be bringing you daily news on television someday soon. And for our final piece, we decided to relax a little and play some video games with Ivan Potocnik.
Look up, child. World is born. Shoes untied. And your soles are worn. Windows are rolled down.
My name is Ivan Potocnik, and I'm a video gamer. Ever since I can remember, I've been a gamer, and it's always proven itself as a great means of entertainment, a wonderful way to escape, and a valuable learning tool to me. Being so vastly interested in gaming and playing such an active role in the community myself, I decided it would make an interesting project to delve deeper and take a more anthropological look at what it means to be a gamer, and what it represents to be part of the modern folk group that is gaming culture. I traveled extensively to various LAN parties trying to learn as much as I can about how people felt about gaming, how it had impacted their lives, and the various rituals and symbols involved with being a gamer. I wanted to remove all the wool and get an honest, objective view of what gaming meant to people. By the way, LAN means local area network. A LAN party is when groups of gamers congregate to link their various machines to more easily, more closely, and more quickly play games with one another. When asked what kind of games people preferred, I got an incredibly wide array of responses.
Warcraft 3,
Final Fantasy 7,
first-person shooters, and massively multiplayer online gaming.
World of Warcraft when it was first released.
Mega Man.
Counter-Strike.
Probably RPGs or MMOs.
I met many interesting people at these parties and even hosted a few myself. Partly because of this, I had the opportunity to sit down with several gamers and ask them how they felt about participating in the gaming community. My first interview was with Michael Johnson.
My name is Michael Johnson. I work at Etc. Etc. in the Southside Mall. I'm a pretty avid gamer, I would say.
Etc. itself is a gaming shop, is it not?
Yes, it is.
My second interview was with Eric Clow.
My name's Eric Clow.
And my third interview was with Scott Goble.
My name's Scott, and I'm a 28-year-old gamer. And I work at Radio Shack, and I like to play video games.
I began by asking each one of them what they thought would be a suitable definition for gaming. First, Michael.
Something as a social gathering for friends and family.
Then Eric.
For me, gaming might be different than it would be for somebody else. Playing games for me, I always play them competitively. I like playing in leagues and that sort of thing.
Then Scott.
Some place I can play and not have any restrictions of reality.
Although we may understand and recognize some of the terms used in the gaming community, I was very interested in asking what some of the more meta, culture-specific vernacular used by the common gamer was. Eric came up with a couple of good ones.
Oh man, there's lots of them. I would say that owned, I would say, probably came from gaming. That's when I've heard it the most. My favorite would be Elite, or 1337, short for Elite. Came from a name of one of the skins you could choose in Counter-Strike. It was like a hacking term.
In researching, I found a multitude of these terms, including leet, pwnage, zomg, WTF, BBQ, hex, C1, noob, rafflecopter, lolcano, and a great many others. Some even consider it its own language, dubbed leet speak, named after the term Eric had explained for me earlier. Although just one opinion, when asked if there was much carryover for gamer vernacular into everyday life, Scott had something very interesting to say.
Barely. Only if I'm hanging out with a select group of people that I know will catch it.
So you're saying that it's very specific to the gamer culture itself?
Yeah, it's my crew.
Another thing that interested me in talking to members of the gaming community were some of the symbols and various rituals involved with being a gamer. Many people I spoke with and my interviewees all responded with a plethora of various rituals prevalent in the gaming world, some healthy and some not so much, demonstrated by Eric's response.
I mean, a lot of people choose to drink energy drinks, stay up very, very late, listen to trance-type music while playing. I mean, all that's kind of shared amongst gamers nowadays, I think. I mean, it's changed a lot.
On the opposite spectrum, Michael currently works in the game industry, having turned his pastime into a daily ritual that is his career. Scott's response interested me, though.
Me and my crew get together and actually, like, group up with laptops and play together.
I found this fascinating, in that although one could consider themselves in a folk group simply by being a gamer, there are even subdivisions within that folk group of smaller, more intimate folk groups. The last course of conversation I took with several of my interviews was that of how gamer culture is perceived by people, including how the gamers within the culture saw themselves. Many of the responses I'd gotten to the question of how society views gamers were surprisingly pessimistic. Both Eric and Michael were quoted as saying that many gamers are seen as dorky and nerdy, and Michael was even quoted as saying that many see gaming as just for children, or for people who are fat and lazy, and is completely a waste of time and money. Scott had this to say about it.
Personally, I don't care how the gaming community is looked at by the outside community, because fuck them if they do judge. Aside from that, generally looked down on upon the mass media and what it does to the youth. I don't know, best quote ever was, give a kid a block of wood and he's going to find a way to hold it as a gun. If gaming is looked at as people just getting together to play, then it's just that, and it's that innocent. It can be looked at from any different aspect, but that's all based on the individual.
Although many of these answers seem quite negative, Eric raised an interesting point about how gaming had adapted and better integrated into today's society.
Originally, it was seen as dorky. I think when I started playing a lot with my friends, it wasn't something that everybody did. Now everybody has an Xbox and everybody games on their consoles and plays Call of Duty online or Halo or a game like that. Now I think it's pretty accepted for the most part. I mean, there's a lot more people playing games for a lot of hours each night than there was back before. Me, I don't know anybody who has any problems with me playing, other than my girlfriend maybe sometimes.
When asked how gamers view themselves, I got a slew of varied responses. The general consensus was that it is not merely a pastime, but also a way of life. It is a means of escape from the everyday world, and at the same time, a great outlet for people looking to learn, be part of a larger, very active online community, and also to compete. Eric even told me that he's gotten more value out of his years of competitive gaming than he ever has from conventional sports or competition. When asked how Michael views himself as a gamer, his response was especially fascinating.
The casual, what you'd find just like an everyday person. I mean, they've done scientific studies showing, you know, video gamers get better hand-eye coordination for other skills. I mean, they actually do give you people skills, too, if you're playing, you know, people online.
Wait a minute. Does that mean that playing video games might actually enhance your social abilities? This was a common theme among many of the gamers I talked to. So what all of these talks boiled down to was, how has gaming as a folk culture affected these people? What have they taken away from it, and what will leave a lasting impression on them? I was surprised to find that, contrary to many of the outside opinions stating that gaming is a waste of time or will rot your brain, people had a strongly positive view on how gaming had affected them and their lives. Almost everyone I talked to was proud to be part of the gaming folk culture and had taken something valuable away from it, like Eric's years of competing and Michael's current career.
When I asked Scott what he'd taken away from it, he did not skip a beat answering me.
Problem solving. Easy stated, problem solving all day, every day. When you're in a video game and something comes up, a boss that you haven't fought before or a situation that you haven't come across before, it's steps that you take to diagnose the situation, to tear it apart and get to a better solution than you have before.
This blew me away. Couldn't life really be seen as all just leading up to the next boss battle? My research and time spent with various members of the gaming community revealed a lot about some of the preconceptions about gamers, and how it's in gamers' very natures to constantly defy them. With a rich culture, language, and set of rituals, it's hard for anyone not to see a little glimmer of gamer within themselves.
That was Ivan Potoknik, avid gamer and audio producer. You've been listening to another collection of student projects from the Spring 2011 Audio Documentary Production class. Join us again next week for the final installment. Until then, I'm Gayana Torosyan.